Thank you. So I would like to now share with you another a framework for understanding racism on three levels, which is quite useful if you're trying to figure out how could racism turn into a health outcome. How, you know, we've already talked about some of these structural things, but how does racism turn into increased obesity prevalence or asthma prevalence or differences in cancer mortality rates and the like? And in order to understand that, I describe racism on three levels: institutionalized, personally mediated, and internalized. So I will define each of these levels. I will give you examples of how they can impact health, and then I will illustrate them with another of my allegories, my gardener's tale. So institutionalized racism is the system, if you will. That's the constellation of structures, policies, practices, norms, values, all of that, that results in differential access to the goods, services, and opportunities of society by race. So this is the kind of racism that doesn't require an identifiable perpetrator. It's the kind of racism that actually shows up as inherited disadvantage or its reciprocal inherited advantage because it's been institutionalized in our customs and laws and background norms. We often see it in terms of material conditions as well as in terms of access to power. So examples of material conditions include differential access by race to excellent educational opportunities, or equal housing opportunities, or equal employment opportunities, or even the same level of income at the same level of employment. Differential access to medical facilities, including linguistic access. Differential access to a clean environment, and the whole very well documented disproportionate placement of toxic dump sites or bus transfer stations in communities of color. And in terms of access to power, it includes access to information. So that could certainly be health information, but it could also be information about our own histories. Okay. So I had talked about institutionalized racism as differential access to the goods, services, and opportunities of society by race, and given you some examples. And when you're talking about access to power, it could be information, it could be resources, so capital resources, or even social networking resources, having a physician with admitting privileges to that hospital, or knowing somebody on the board, and even voice in government or media and the like. Now, when I talk about these examples of institutionalized racism, and when I talk about housing and education and employment and income, sometimes people ask me, Dr. Jones, isn't that really social class? So why are you having that on a slide about racism? Are you talking about racism or are you really talking about social class? That is a very important question. So let me answer that for you. And the first part of my answer starts with the observation that it doesn't just so happen that people of color in this country are overrepresented in poverty, while white people in this country are overrepresented in wealth. It's not just a happenstance. And for each marginalized or stigmatized or oppressed group of color, there's been some initial historical injustice. And I don't have time to go through all of the different myriad examples, so I'm just going to lift two for you. First of all, let's talk about American Indians, where the initial historical injustice was the taking of the land, and then the near genocide, and then the moving of survivors to reserved lands, reservations, right? But then in some instances, something good was found under one reservation. Oops, you got to pick them up and move them somewhere else. And then let's talk about people of African descent, where the initial historical injustice was the kidnapping of West African people and our importation across the Atlantic with tremendous loss of life in the Middle Passage. And then for the survivors and their progeny, what I describe as the coerced usury of our unpaid labor for centuries to build this country. But then some people hear me talk like that and they say, oh, Dr. Jones, there you go, talking about slavery. And Dr. Jones, don't you know that the enslaved people were emancipated in 1865? And we are now in 2016, so that's now 151 years ago. So Dr. Jones, all else being equal, don't you think the impacts of slavery would have washed out by now? But of course, the key phrase there is all else being equal. And all else hasn't been equal since 1865, and all else still is not equal today. And there are what I describe as present-day contemporary structural factors that are perpetuating each of the initial historical injustices of people who've been marginalized or stigmatized or oppressed. And these contemporary structural factors are part and parcel of institutionalized racism. So that when somebody asks, are you talking about racism, or aren't you really talking about social class? I explain that institutionalized racism explains why we even see an association between social class and race in this country. It's an important observation because it means that you cannot reduce this to a social class argument or intervention. Certainly, it is crucial for us to eliminate poverty across this land in all groups. I am all on board. In fact, if you gave me a magic wand, I would go further than eliminating poverty. I would flatten the whole thing out. I would eliminate income inequality because, as Dr. Archer talked about, income inequality is a big predictor of violence, a big predictor of adverse health outcomes in all populations and the like. So, boom, I'm going to use that magic wand right now. But if I do that without addressing the background structures, policies, practices, norms, and values, the background mechanisms of institutionalized racism that were put in place to shunt different populations into different possibilities. If I eliminated income inequality today without addressing institutionalized racism, then in 20 years, in one generation, we would start to see a stratification by race again in terms of income. So certainly we must address poverty, but we must also address institutionalized racism if we're going to have any kind of traction on these issues. I also need to say, before I leave institutionalized racism, that it can be through acts of doing, acts of commission, as well as acts of not doing, acts of omission. And very often, institutionalized racism shows up as inaction in the face of need. The second level of racism, personally mediated racism, I define as differential assumptions about the abilities, motives, and intents of others by race, and then differential actions based on those assumptions. So this is what most people think of when they hear the word racism. Somebody did something to somebody. It includes the different idea, the prejudice, and the different action, the discrimination. And in fact, you know, people call this interpersonal racism. I call it personally mediated racism because I am still understanding racism as a system. And this is the system mediated through people. Examples include police brutality. We've talked a little bit about that. I used to give the example of, imagine you were pulled over for driving while black or driving while Latino, interpreted as resisting arrest and hit upside the head. But now we can lift up a whole litany of names. And you know, this is stuck in time now, and I'm so afraid that there's going to be more names next week and the week after and the week after. You know, we go beyond Mike Brown and Walter Scott and Eric Garner and little baby Tamir Rice and Sam DuBose and Sandra Bland and on and on and on and on and on and on. And it's not a problem just for the families or the doctors who are caring for the patient or the families. It's a problem for whole communities that are just bracing ourselves for the next occurrence because of the lack, for the most part, of accountability on the part of law enforcement for these police killings of unarmed black and brown men and women. Personally mediated racism also manifests as physician disrespect. Here I am, a physician, speaking to physicians, but we have to acknowledge that physician disrespect can be subtle, like a physician not giving a patient the full range of treatment options because the physician figures that patient couldn't afford or wouldn't comply or wouldn't understand or whatever they think about the patient. Or it could be quite blatant, like sterilization abuse, which has had many iterations in our nation's history. Shopkeeper vigilance is another example, being followed around in stores, or waiter indifference, not getting quick, respectful treatment. And these are just two examples of what many people call everyday racism, the microaggressions, just the subtle communication of disrespect that might even be related to elevated blood pressures in communities of color, blood pressures that we've shown don't even go down at night. And then teacher devaluation is a very, very important manifestation of personally mediated racism. We already talked about the suspensions of preschool children. But you know, if a teacher looks at a young child and thinks that child can't learn, and puts them off in the ADD, the attention deficit disorder track, that child will never even know their full potential, much less have the opportunity to develop to their full potential. And all of these examples of personally mediated racism are like institutionalized in that it can be through acts of doing, acts of commission, as well as acts of not doing, acts of omission. But even more important is to recognize that personally mediated racism can be unintentional as well as intentional. You do not have to have intended to do something racist to have had a racist impact. The third level of racism, internalized racism, I define here from the point of view of members of the stigmatized races, as acceptance by members of the stigmatized races of negative messages about our own abilities and intrinsic worth. And I actually have anti-racism, you know, organizers, friends who are, you know, friends of mine who do that kind of work, who say, well, Dr. Jones, Kamara, What about the internalized sense of entitlement that many white people are walking around with? Isn't that also internalized racism? And yes, indeed it is. And I actually really hadn't explicitly dealt with that. And now I'm going to say something that might be a little sensitive right now, but actually that sense of entitlement may be about to hurt our whole country. I don't know. But anyway, from the point of view of members of the stigmatized races, examples of how internalized racism can impact our health includes self-devaluation, feeling maybe I'm really not as good as, so maybe I won't try to graduate from high school or apply to that college or apply for that job or try to live in that neighborhood. The white man's ice is colder syndrome, that phraseology, the white man's ice is colder, comes from my parents' generation. What it meant then for people of color, it still means for many of us today. So say that I'm black and I need a lawyer, I might actually go seek out a white lawyer over a black lawyer. Or if I'm sick, I might prefer a white doctor over a black doctor. In fact, if my lemonade is warm, I might go way down the street to get the white man's ice over the black man's ice, deeply believing that the white man's ice is colder, deeply internalizing the myth of white superiority. Resignation, helplessness, hopelessness, all of these turn into self-destructive health behaviors, if you will. And they also can turn into not registering to vote or not voting even if you are registered. And all of these manifestations of internalized racism are basically us accepting the limitations to our own full humanity of the box into which we've been placed. So that when we hear young high school students of color teasing one of their friends who's trying to be the valedictorian by saying, well, you know, so-and-so is just trying to be black, you know, we need to challenge that, because since when did black people, I mean, that so-and-so is just trying to be white, you know? So since when did white people claim exclusive access to excellence? They did not. So now I'm going to illustrate these three levels of racism, institutionalized, personally mediated, and internalized, with another of my allegories. This one I call my gardener's tale. It's actually published in the American Journal of Public Health in 2000. It's 4 pages front and back. If you like it, please share it. You could even Google Kamara Jones Gardener's Tale and find me saying it many, many times. I don't have a web page myself, but you know, people always putting my stuff up there. So here, let me start with what really happened to me in my life, and then we'll make it a story about racism. So my husband and I had been married about a year. When I went back to Baltimore, we moved back because I was going to finish my PhD at Hopkins, and we bought our first freestanding house. Cute little house, big wraparound porch with flower boxes dotted all over the porch. And we bought this house in October, so we weren't even thinking about those flower boxes in the fall. Winter's coming. But when spring came, my husband, who's the gardener, ran out with our marigold seeds getting ready to decorate our cute little porch. And then he said, oh, some of these flower boxes have dirt in them, but some of the boxes are empty. So he went down to the gardening store and he hauled big old bags of potting soil back and filled up the empty boxes. And then we put equal numbers of marigold seeds in all of the boxes and we watered them all. And I'm not the gardener in the family, so I sat back just gonna, you know, be delighted, right? Well, about 3 weeks later, as I'm leaving the house, walked out of my front door, and I actually stopped in my tracks as I looked at the flower boxes on our porch. Because when I looked at them, it looked to me like we had planted completely different species in some boxes versus the others. Some of the boxes were full of plants, and they were tall, vigorous-looking plants. And some of the boxes just had a few plants in them, and even those were scrawny and scraggly-looking. And then I realized what had happened. That potting soil that my husband had bought turned out to be rich, fertile soil, so that every single seed planted in the rich, fertile soil had sprouted. The strong seed had grown very tall and vigorous, but even the weak seed had made it halfway up. But that old soil that we had found there turned out to be poor, rocky soil. So the weak seed planted in the poor, rocky soil had just died, and even the strong seed had to struggle to make it to a middling height. And some of you guys are nodding, so maybe there's some gardeners out there in the audience, and so maybe you've composted half of your garden, and maybe you've seen this image with your own real eyes, and the image is really about the importance of the soil, the importance of the environment. But now I'm going to take this image and I'm going to make it a story about racism by introducing a gardener. So now we're going to have a gardener who has two flower boxes, one which she knows to have rich, fertile soil, one which she knows to have poor, rocky soil, and she has seed for the same kind of flowers, except some of the seed is going to produce pink blossoms, and some of the seed is going to produce red blossoms, and the gardener prefers red over pink. So what does she do? She takes the red seed, puts it in the rich, fertile soil, pink seed in the poor, rocky soil, and 3 weeks later, in her flower boxes, she sees what I saw in mine. In that rich, fertile soil, all of the red seed has sprouted. Strong red seed has grown tall and vigorous, and even the weak red seed makes it halfway up. In that poor, rocky soil, the weak pink seed dies. And here comes the strong pink seed, struggling to make it to a middling height. And then in those two flower boxes, those flowers go to seed. And the next year, same thing happens. And then those flowers go to seed. And year after year after year after year, the same thing happens. Until finally, about 10 years later, the gardener's looking at her flower boxes, and she says, "You know, I was right to prefer red over pink." So we interrupt the story to say the first part of this story is how institutionalized racism works, where you had the initial historical injustice of the separation of the seed into the two types of soil, you had the contemporary structural factors of the flower boxes keeping the soil separate, and then through inaction in the face of need, perpetuation of the inequity. But let's pick the story back up to say, well, where is personally mediated racism in the garden? Well, the gardener's looking over at red, thinking red is beautiful. And then she looks at the pink flowers and she says, "Oh, those flowers sure are scrawny and scraggly," so she plucks off the pink blossoms before they can even go to seed. Or she might notice that a pink seed has blown into the rich, fertile soil, so she plucks it out before it can establish itself, which is some of the anti-affirmative action stuff that goes on. And where would internalized racism be in the garden? Well, the red flowers are just living their lives, enjoying being red, many of them not even understanding or acknowledging that they're benefiting from enriched soil. Pink flowers are looking over at red, thinking red is mighty fine and wishing with all their hearts that they too could be red. And here come the bees. And the bees are just minding their own business, collecting nectar, but they're pollinating at the same time. So here comes a bee, bzzz, into one of the pink flowers, and then bzzz, to another pink flower, and then bzzz, to this pink flower. And this flower's like, "Get away from me, bee. Do not bring me any of that pink pollen. I prefer the red." Because the pink flower has internalized that red is better than pink. So now the question arises, what do we do to set things right in this garden? Well, we could start by addressing the internalized racism, so we can go over to the pink flowers and we can say, "Pink is beautiful, power to the pink." And that's a very good intervention, but if that's all we do, it's not going to change the situation in which they find themselves. Or you might say, okay, well, let's address the personally mediated racism. So let's have a conversation with the gardener. Or better yet, let's have a workplace multicultural workshop for the gardener, which is all good. So we have our workshop, and in the workshop we say, "Dear gardener, would you please stop plucking those pink flowers?" And maybe she will, and maybe she won't. But even if she does, it's still not going to change the situation in which the pink flowers find themselves. If we really want to set things right in this garden, we need to address the institutionalized racism, which means we have to either break down the boxes and mix up the soil, or if you want to keep separate boxes, that's all right too, although it makes it easier for the gardener to continue segregating resources going forward. But if you keep separate boxes, it certainly means that you need to enrich that poor rocky soil until it is as rich as the rich, fertile soil. And when you do that, the pink flowers will flourish. They'll be looking beautiful, grand, and glorious, so that in that intervention on the institutionalized racism, you'll also have addressed the internalized, because pink won't be looking over at red, thinking red is better or wanting to be red. And in the intervention on the institutionalized, you may also address the personally mediated racism. Now, the original gardener may have to go to her grave preferring red over pink, but her children who grow up and see the flowers equally beautiful would be less likely to have that kind of attitude. So this story has been to illustrate those three levels of racism and to strongly suggest that if we want to set things right in the garden, we need to at least address the institutionalized racism. And good to address all the levels at the same time, but we have to at least address the institutionalized, and when we do, the other levels may take care of themselves. And before I leave the story, there's one more question that we haven't even raised yet, which is, who is the gardener? After all, the gardener is the one that I gave the power to decide, the power to act, and control of resources, which in my mind are actually the elements of self-determination. Who is the gardener? Well, certainly government is a huge part of the gardener, but not the only part. Media, foundations, corporations, maybe your medical practice, communities to the extent that they have self-determination, but whoever the gardener is, it is dangerous when the gardener is allied with one group. I painted her red, that's why she prefers red over pink. And it's also dangerous when she's not concerned with equity, when she can look at her flower boxes and think that her garden is beautiful, thank you, because she's not even counting the pink flowers as part of her garden. So the question, the challenge for us is what to do about the gardener. Do we make the gardener striped or polka-dotted or fuchsia? Do the pink flowers have to grow or recruit their own gardener? Lots of questions can come out of this. And I look forward to the opportunity to raising some of the questions that I've heard in the past and also hearing questions from you. So thank you very much. Do you want to just come up, Dr. Archer, and then we do, yes.
Well, maybe I could take a question while she's adjusting. Or maybe I could say, do you remember the picture while we're looking at that?
I was once asked, after telling this story, excuse me, Dr. Jones, but why should the red flowers share their soil? And I loved that question. First of all, I loved it because it showed the power of this story to start conversations on racism that might otherwise be difficult if we were talking about racism between you and me. But my answer to that question, why should the red flowers share their soil, is that actually that soil doesn't belong to the red flowers, it belongs to the whole garden. Also think about this, what if the picture, the gardener that we're looking at is not the original gardener, but the gardener's great-great-great-great-grandchild? Here we are. And that great-great-great-great-grandchild has always seen the pink and red flowers looking like that, may not even think there's a problem. So just on that point, there are three quick things we need to understand. We need to make the differences in the height and vigor of the pink and red flowers a problem. We need to make the flower boxes transparent so that we can talk about the differences in the quality of the soil. And we need to make it clear that the pink seed did not just launch themselves into the poor rocky soil. So we have to talk about history. And we also need to talk about the gardener's preference for red over pink that set up the whole situation. So I used to just think about structures and the quality of the soil, but we also need to think about the values piece. Because the gardener's initial preference for red over pink, that cultural racism, if you will, or what in our context is white supremacist ideology, set up the whole situation. And if the gardener, even if we could compel the gardener to enrich that poor rocky soil today, if she continues to prefer red over pink, she'll continue to privilege red over pink going forward. So we have to address both the opportunity structures and the societal valuation if we're going to set things right.